afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about redo logging. I mentioned this idea of we always log first, then indicate that we've written down the entire transaction, and then we do the actual operations. And sort of when we've written that message saying we have the entire transaction, that commit, we will actually do the operations in the future at some point. So if we have a crash, that means we're going to do them on reboot. We're going to check the log and say, oh, have to do this again just in case it wasn't done. Also means our log operations need to be idempotent. They need to be safe to do a second time. Then we started talking about distributed systems. We mentioned we'd have a bunch of machines working together to run one big program. And I talked about, well, why would we want to do this? It's more complicated to have a program split across multiple machines. It's extra work. And you know, often we could probably do it on one machine. So what are our reasons for doing that? Talked about some social reasons, that often you'll have different people who want to have their data on their own machine and they want to work together. And that's going to mean that we're going to end up with a distributed system, not because we couldn't run everything on one machine, but because the people in responsible don't want to put that all in one machine together. They aren't willing to have that all in one place. We also talk about technical reasons, that you know, we can have machines that do a lot, but they're expensive, and they can only go so far. And we think that multiple machines working together can do more than a single machine can, and for cheaper or more efficiently. And also that maybe we can handle failures, which is going to be a topic for later today, that you know, if something goes wrong, that hopefully having multiple machines should let us deal with one or more of those machines failing, as long as not everything fails. So then we looked at ways of organizing distributed systems, and sort of the predominant model is this client-server idea, that we have some clients that are sometimes on, which contact servers that are always available. And I mentioned in practice, we often have these change of client-server relationships. So in one context, something will be a server, and for some other purpose, it will be a client. And that's how sort of how many modern distributed systems are constructed, is with this sort of chain of design. So if we have this client-server model, we can talk about, well, how do machines actually communicate with each other? And we talked about, well, what sort of service does our network provide? And we mentioned our network has this sort of mailbox model that we can send basically the equivalent of letters addressed to somewhere, and the network will handle routing that to the appropriate machine based on some address. And we mentioned, well, we have addresses that the network expects, and those are not the same as sort of names we actually use as humans to identify machines, that there's the address is something that's in a format that the network finds useful. We found out for machines, we have these IP addresses, which are just numbers, because when we're deciding how to send messages, we're going to have tables of these numbers go here. We're not going to know how to deal with the names. We're not going to do that. But also we mentioned, well, if I have a machine running a bunch of different things, like a SSH server and a web server, I need to know who is the message for, which of those programs is the message for. And to do that, we add on to these addresses for machines these port numbers to identify a particular program on a machine. And instead, our network provides this that way we can sort of send these individual messages. But in practice, that's not actually usually how we want to communicate. We're thinking of the client-server model. We want the client to send something to the server and the server to be able to reply back. And the way we're going to do this with the mailbox models, we're going to have the client send, oh, here's my return address. But we have an abstraction that sort of automates that process for us called a connection. And the sort of what connections give us is this sort of two-way pipe. So the client's going to set up this pipe by sending an initial message to the server. But once it's set up, the way that the client and server program are written is that they're going to just read and write from this two-way pipe. In POSIX, this is represented by actual file descriptors that work very much like pipes, except both reading and writing. And this can be built atop the mailbox model. And so this is one way we can communicate between different machines. One abstraction we can use. The connection model is pretty useful. But we talked about sort of a higher level view last time, which was this idea of remote procedure calls, that we would have something that looks like a function call, but actually calls something on a remote machine. The idea is that when we're typically doing something on the same machine, if we're calling code on the same machine, well, we make function calls. Can we just make that work despite the function actually running on a remote machine? And the idea from remote procedure calls is, well, we're going to try to do that. And we're going to try to do that by having some library stand in for the function on the remote machine, on the client machine and on the server machine where we're going to actually run the function. We're going to have the library stand in for the caller, you know, and it's going to handle transmitting the information about that function call over the network. That's what we're going to finish up talking about today. Before we move on to that, questions about things we covered last time or the quiz? Yes? Can I go over question 5 on the quiz? Okay. Let's pull that out and go to 11. So on the quiz, question 5 said we had a chat system implemented with the client-server model. We have two clients, A and B, and a server. And we want client A to send a message, chat message to client B. How is this going to happen? We have this single server and these two clients. And the big problem with many of these proposals is that they might work, but they aren't the client-server model anymore. We have a messaging system that's sort of a hybrid of client-server and peer-to-peer. Because remember, a key thing about the client-server model is that our clients know how to contact the server. The server only knows how to reply back to the clients. It doesn't know how to contact a client proactively. The only way it can contact a client is if a client first contacts it. And our clients generally aren't going to be things that receive messages from elsewhere. So, for example, our first proposal here, that the server would open a connection to the client and send a message to it, well, the client needs to initiate that. The server is not able to contact the clients proactively. Option C, you know, that the server would respond with a way to connect, or option C and D are both the server would like give the client enough information to send, you know, to either receive the message proactively or send it proactively, but this requires that either A or B become a server effectively, or we have a sort of more a peer-to-peer model. So both of those are just not using the client server. It's not that they wouldn't work, not that they're not a way that might not be a good way to have a chat system, that it's not a chat system where A and B are really clients. So the question, how the server would send a message directly to a client. So in option B, the reason the server can do that is the client opened a connection to the server and said, give me the messages you have. And it's just, and when it's sending the message to the client B, it's just replying to that request. So it's the same kind of idea as if when your web browser opens up and says, tell me what's on this web page, you were saying, tell me about all the messages. But the server is not initiating the action, so there's no problem figuring out how do I get to client B. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes? Question in option B, would the server be responsible for saving the message a client sends until the receiving client opens a connection? Yes, or we need to have a policy like you can't send a message from to B unless B already has started requested messages. Both of which are things real systems do. So if you think of the saving the messages, like this is basically how email works in practice. We both use Gmail, right? It's effectively how it works. And there are chat systems which work more like if you can only send a message to B if B is already connected and requested messages back. That answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
How do you determine the max file size in an
inode? How do we determine the max file size in an inode system? So in this system, if we think of storing a file, we're going to want to store as much as possible. So I'm just going to look at what I have in my inode. I'm going to try to use it as much as possible. So in my inode, I have four, highlight the line. I have four direct block pointers. So I'm gonna use all four of them. That is gonna give me four times the block size bytes of data I can store. Then I'm gonna have an indirect pointer. That's gonna point to a block. I'm gonna fill all of that block. So I'm gonna fill 2048 bytes with block pointers. So that gives me 512 block pointers just because I'm doing some division, 2048 divided by 4. That gives me 512 blocks of data I can point to. And so that's extra 512 times 2048 bytes of data. That makes sense?
And where's the
512 is I have 2048 bytes to store block pointers divided by 4 bytes per pointer from the last bullet.
So having
question, does the one of them being indirect, one of them double indirect make a difference? So I've only got to the indirect yet. So to get to the double indirect, for the double indirect pointer, I can store a block of 512 pointers. Each of those 512 pointers are going to point to another 512 pointers. So I'm going to have 512 squared pointers in total in the last level only, that each point to a block of data, so I have 512 squared times 2048 in addition. So I add up all those steps, I have the direct pointer, the indirect pointer, and the double indirect pointer, I add up all the numbers I got from the steps, and the total, that's the total size I can have. And you might be concerned, wait a moment, we only have a million blocks available, you'll find out that that total is less than a million blocks. So that's not a concern. Question, would the size be 4 times 2048 direct pointers, 512 times 20 plus 512 times 2048 indirect pointer plus 5 times square times 2048 double indirect pointer? Yes. Other questions? Yeah, and I guess, right. And that was indeed not the question I asked here, but other questions, things we covered last time or the quiz. Okay. So last time we were talking about remote procedure calls. So here's sort of our overall flow for remote procedure calls. We're gonna have a client program that's gonna make a function call. And that function call should look like a normal function call. The easiest way to do that is make it be actually a function call. It's just not gonna call the function directly because, well, that's on a different machine. So that's gonna call what we'll call a client stub. And this is gonna be generated by some compiler-like tool that's gonna generate a function that has the same prototype as the function we want to imitate. But instead of actually doing whatever it's gonna do on the remote machine, it's going to convert our arguments to bytes and send them to this library that's going to deal with sending them over the network. And then that's going to end up in some code we'll call the server stub, which is going to take those bytes and convert them back into arguments and then call the function on the server, the real version of the function. This real version of the function is going to return some sort of value. This is going to convert that return value back into bytes, send it back over the network, which is going to then be decoded again by this client stub. So we can return from that function call as if the return value is produced locally. But actually, it's produced by decoding whatever was sent over the network. And over the network, we're going to send these bytes we got from the arguments along with some way of identifying which of several functions that we might implement is being called. And we're going to send back sort of the return value or information about, oh, this didn't work, like I don't have that function or something like that. So questions about this sort of overall operation and what this client and server stub do in here? have our client stub, which is going to look like, so this is looks like a function, and our server stub looks like a function caller. And that's sort of the roles that we have. And those are going to be generated by the library. Questions? Okay. So one of the things these stubs need to do is they need to send the arguments over the network. You might say, okay, so I get a bunch of function arguments, I just copy them, right, into the bytes I'm going to send over the network. So why is it bytes over the network? Well, if we think of read and write, what we have for connections, well, we pass bytes. But I cannot just copy the bytes of the arguments. That doesn't work. And there's a bunch of reasons why this doesn't work. So one reason it doesn't work is that if I think of sort of a sort of natural way I might have my functions work, you know, I might say, you know, if I have void star foo char star arg, how do I pass arg to the remote machine? Or to give sort of a better example, if I have, you know, char star arg 1 and int arg 2, how do I pass arg to the remote machine? If I just copy the value of arg 1, well, it's a pointer. That pointer is not going to be meaningful on the other machine. The other machine has different memory. So I can't just copy the pointer value. So I'm going to want to copy like something about what it points to. And I don't really know here, if I just look at this, what that's supposed to be. Is arg1 like a null terminated string? Should I copy until I see a null character? Is arg1 size bytes, arg2 bytes long? I don't really have that information. So I'm going to need some way of figuring that out. And I'm going to need, you know, information beyond just like looking at the arguments and copying. Also, a typical goal of RPC systems is to deal with having the client and server be running different architectures. So the client might be a 32-bit machine, the server might be a 64-bit machine, and we want that to work. And so typically, we're not going to, you know, just pass an int as is. We're going to have some normalized form, some standard way of passing it, so that we don't have to worry about, is this a 32 or 64-bit machine? We're going to have some idea of what we're always going to pass, so that always works. We don't have to worry about whether the server is a different platform. So we don't have to make an RPC system which does that, but most RPC systems have this goal of letting you have the client and server run on very different types of machines, and usually even letting the client and server being like written in different programming languages. Which is going to require us to do much more than just copying the values, even after taking into account things like pointers. And I guess another issue with this pointer case is, you know, I'm sort of assuming I'm going to copy the value of arg1, but sometimes we even have other things like, you know, for example, if you think of the read function in POSIX, it modifies the thing pointed to by what you pass in. Like, passing that over is much more complicated, right? We want to make that work. So, given that, you know, not only am I going to need to do extra work to pass these arguments that have things like pointers, but also, I just don't have enough information. If I look at my declaration in, say, my C header file, or in any other programming language, like if I have a Python function that takes arg1, arg2, I don't really know how that information is supposed to be passed over the network. And I can't figure that out by just looking at the normal thing we'd write. So for this reason, typically we're going to have what's called an interface description language, that our RPC tool and library is going to have a special language for specifying what our remote procedure calls are, what arguments they take, what return values they take, rather than us just giving a function declaration. And they kind of have to do this, partly because the function declaration isn't enough, and partly because they want to handle being programming language neutral and architecture neutral. And this interface description language is generally what will be compiled into stubs and the marshalling, unmarshalling code, the code that converts the arguments to bytes, converts the return values to bytes, and back from bytes. So we could just use a source file. Like, it's not unheard of for someone to try to make an RPC system that works that way, but there's just so much that there's information we're missing, and it's very hard to just use a source file and be machine or programming language neutral. Like, in C, if I have an int that's different on different machines, we want to have defining a language where, you know, we say what type of it is every time, and it's the same on every machine. And another thing we're going to want to deal with is going to be compatibility. So something which can happen with RPC is that I can have my client running version 1 of my software and my server running version 2. And if my client makes a procedure call with, say, some arguments missing, we need to make sure we know what's going to happen. And so typically RPC systems also want to have a separate interface description language so they can deal with defining what happens in that sort of scenario. What happens if I upgrade my client without upgrading my server, or upgrade my server without upgrading my client, and the function calls change? How is that supposed to work? With normal function calls, well, that's not a problem because, you know, when you try to link to a library, it's just not going to work. But here, we're going to discover this problem as things are running because we can easily separately upgrade the two parts, the client and the server. Some questions, reasons we want an interface description language. Okay, so we're gonna look at an example of the Google RPC system. It's what we're gonna use for an upcoming assignment, and it's a real industrial example, which shows sort of maybe that the promise of it looks like a normal function call. It's kind of there, but we haven't, that's not really a super high priority. So here is an example of the interface description language for Google RPC. So we define these messages, which are basically like structs. And these messages have a bunch of fields, and the fields are all identified with a number. So this number is how the message is ID'd over the network. And in particular, a big part of this is that I can change the name of this field. So if I decide, wait, path, that was a mistake, it should really be file name. I can change this to file name, and everything that doesn't know about that change will still work because it's really identified by the number 1. When it's sent, we're going to look at number for 1, marking this thing regardless of what it's called. And this also gives us sort of a plan of what if I add arguments? Well, I'm going to have new fields that I don't know about, but I know it's field number 2. So I define this sort of message. And in the Google RPC system, they made a choice that every method we function we define, well, first of all, it's going to be part of a group of functions called a service. And it's going to take a message as argument and return a message as an argument. So if you want to have different numbers of arguments, well, you're just going to have different numbers of fields in the message. They just made a decision, we're not going to have multiple arguments in other ways. Even though that makes it look less like a normal RPC call, they just felt that that was easier, more consistent, easier to make work consistently with different versions of things and across languages. So in this example, we have a call we can make called makeDirectory, a function, which takes this message as arguments, which in this case only specifies a path, and returns a message called empty, which is just presumably a message which doesn't have anything interesting in it, and no fields. And when I make a call to this function, so I'm going to call my stub called makeDirectory, the client stub, and that's going to have to be sent over the network somehow. An example of what might happen, this is not really what gRPC does, but this is sort of in the vein of what you would do. I'm not going to say what gRPC does because that involves explaining a bunch of things which aren't especially interesting for what we're talking about in this course. So an example of a way you could do this is I could send the name makeDirectory, and I need to say how long the name is, so I just have a byte, which is the length of the name, followed by the arguments, where I mark each argument, which is number. So I mark argument 1 with a byte 1 to indicate it's argument 1. Then I have the length is, in this case, 4 characters. So I say 1, 4 characters, and so on. And just have some consistent format. And the idea is I just choose a format like this, and I can easily decode it on the other end. And in this case, I can even decode it in a way where if there's extra arguments that I didn't know about, I can at least decode them, even if I don't know how to handle them. And this is sort of an example of how the RPC system might transfer this request into something that we can send to the remote machine. And these are just bytes we can send through by writing to a socket. Then they can be read at the other end and then passed to some decoding routine. So questions about sort of this idea for how we might marshal things and what's in this IDL example, sort of the example description of what the RPC calls. Yes? What does string path equals 1 signify? So this says that there's a field called path. So this is a field in basically a struct or a class. And it has number identifier number 1. And that number 1 is used over the network to say what field it is, which means that we can change the name of this field, and it doesn't matter for the purposes of, am I going to pass the same argument? Over the network, it's just identified by the number 1. So you can kind of think of the 1 as like an address for the field versus we have a name which we can change separately from that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. And the reason that gRPC chooses to have these is so that we can easily rename fields or add fields or remove fields and be able to deal with the extra or missing fields because they're just basically, because we send them over the network as field number X. That makes it tractable to later on say, oh, there's an additional field I don't know about, but it's field number 2, and we can deal with that later. Okay, so I'm going to show some gRPC code to use it, and we'll get back to a more full description of the interface description link. So we're going to go through an example where we call this make directory function. That's our remote function. And I'm going to call that from a client. And gRPC, I'm going to show the Python instance of the code it generates. That's what we're going to use in an upcoming assignment. It's simpler than the C++ stuff, especially because if we actually use the C++ stuff for the assignment, I'd have to talk about smart pointers, which I don't think is a good use of our time. So on the client side, we get a stub. And the stub is going to be basically an object, a Python object in this case. And I just make method calls on those objects. And those methods are going to stand in for the remote function. So that's a local method call. But it's going to end up sending a message over the network and calling a function that's implemented on the server. And on the server, the way we're going to specify these functions is that the RPC library will have defined for us a base class, in this case called directory servicer, that we're going to inherit from, and we're going to implement override some methods on that class, and that's the methods that we're going to be called. There's some stuff here that you might say, this isn't so transparent, which is partly because, looking exactly like a local function call maybe wasn't the gRPC designer's highest priority, even though maybe they could have done more of that. So one example, as I mentioned, that our arguments are always going to be messages. And that means that I don't just pass path. I pass make an object. This make directory args here is a constructor call. So this is sort of the same thing as new make directory args. That's what it would be equivalent to in C++, probably. Something like that. So that's basically a constructor call. rather than passing the arguments directly because of this choice that all the arguments are messages. In the server side, I have some extra stuff. I have my, from how Python object orientation works, a this argument to my function because it has to be a method rather than just a normal function, just because of how I bind it to this is part of the server I want you to implement when I'm using the RPC library. And I also have an extra argument we'll talk about in a bit. Okay, so questions so far? Yes. What is directories impl? So this is a class that we implement on the server that's just a container for our the functions we want to be callable.
What is impl?
What does impl mean? Implementation. And this is just a name I chose. There's nothing special about it. Other questions? Okay, so we have our call on the client side. So sort of if this were just a normal Python function, we just call make directory path equals. Here we have some extra steps. We have to have this stub thing to indicate, which we're going to see how that's set up in a bit, which says that this is correlated to a particular server. We have to pass the arguments in a different way just because gRPC chose, oh, we're going to always pass arguments as this sort of struct. On the server side, you know, I can't just define a normal function. I have to define it as a method of a class. So I have this extra self argument. And I also have this context argument. And we can see one of the things I can do with this context argument is I can use it to like trigger an error on the client. And generally the context argument is how we're gonna get things that like wouldn't happen with a normal function call. Like, you know, we can raise exceptions, but we can't, you know, trigger specific error messages, especially in languages that aren't Python, right? That we need to interact with. I might want to figure out what machine is the client on. The context variable will let me query like the address of the client, which obviously wouldn't make sense in a local function call. And anything like that, that's what that extra variable is for. And they said, rather than making this look like a normal function, we're gonna have you get this extra stuff just in case you want that. Even though, yes, they could have said, no, you're just gonna return a value and you're not gonna have access to any of that extra functionality. They said, well, maybe you'll need that extra functionality and it's worth having you have to write this function differently than a normal function. So we have our context and our stub, and we need these path information around. I mentioned we have our struct argument, so that's what becomes this request here. And I'm inheriting from a base class. This is the Python syntax for extends, is the parentheses, basically, is directory impl extends directory servicer. And that's how I specify to the RPC library where my function implementations are. This is just the interface that they chose. So questions? So far. So I've shown you sort of the code. Let's look at what the full IDL for this might look. So in this case, I've made sort of separate messages. I have two functions I implement. I have a make directory and a list directory function. And they take the same arguments, but I've made different messages for their arguments just because I expect that they'll change in different ways. I might add an argument to make directory, you know, like maybe I say, oh, I want to have a mode I pass to make directory, and I want to be able to do that, add that field later on without needing to change list directory args where that mode argument wouldn't make any sense. And you can see also that we have support for basically arrays. So gRPC's IDL has something called repeated fields, and that's sort of how they represent things like arrays. So this, remember, is programming language neutral. So in C++, this is going to turn into something similar to a vector in Python, this is going to turn into something like a list. And they just call it repeated because it's supposed to be language neutral, so we can't like make it look like a Python list, we can't make it look like a C++ vector, so they just have their own way of specifying that. And then just map it to something appropriate for each programming language you might call this from. And this is where they've just made a decision that, well, it's not going to look like a normal function call quite because we want it to work no matter what programming language you wrote it in, even though like making a vector and making a list, you know, kind of look very different. Okay. So we have our messages, and each of these messages is going to be turned into their own C++ class or Python class. So there's basically a translator from this source code to Python source code or C++ source code or a bunch of other languages that will generate classes for each of these things. We're going to use these field numbers to indicate which field is passed over the network so I can rename things without changing the number, and what's sent over the network is exactly the same. So I can fix, like, if I name something wrong errors. And I have my two functions I define as part of this service that I'm going to implement. And in our sort of Python implementation, each of these becomes a method that we need to implement in a class. Questions? And all, I guess also that the client will have available to them in the class they get. So questions? So we have our implementations. So usually it's straightforward. So I get my request. I can look at the path with .path and call things. And I have to return something. So I return an empty message, which is just this message I defined here, which has no fields. And similarly, I have this case where I have my list and the sort of list-like thing they give me in Python, I can append to, just like I can append to a Python list once I initialize a return object type. So I've shown sort of implementing the methods, calling the methods, haven't shown how we, you know, set that up. So there's some setup to make that work. So one thing is on the server, I need to specify to run things, and the way I do that is I make a RPC server with the so-called library to tell it to do that, and it turns out internally they use a thread pool, so in this case I've said start a thread pool with 3 worker threads. So probably very much like your thread pool, except this thread pool is going to run function calls, remote function calls on your server. So in this case, up to 3 of them can run at a time. And then I call this generated function where I take the sort of class I implemented. So this is the class I implemented. And I make an instance of that class. So new object of class I implemented. Class I implemented, pass it to the system, and it's going to, oh, I forgot argument here. Server, add it to the server, register it, and then I can start the server. In this case, I specify a IP address and a port number that the server is going to run on and say start. And then it's going to get requests from a client and going to call the class I just passed it in. On the client side, I'll make this number match. I'm going to specify the address of the server, address and port number, the full address, I should say. And then I'm going to make a client stub. And there's going to be a class that's defined for our service, which has methods that correspond to all the methods I defined in the IDL. So in this case, I make a stub for the directory service, and then I can call stub.makeDirectory because that was something I defined in that IDL. And it's going to send a message over the network to the server, and so on. And I can do similarly for the other methods. So questions about sort of the server setup? Parts of, and client setup parts of this. And I think this clarifies why we need the stub object, why they have the stub object. It's because so they have a place to store what are you connecting to in Python rather than like having it be a global variable or something. Yes?
So in the
Question is the port number they're referring to the port number the server has open? Yes. So it should match the port number I passed you. Other questions? Okay. So, seeing RPC, so I mentioned we had this sort of promise that we can make RPC really transparent. We can make it really look like a local procedure call. And you can see that, well, it kind of looks like a local procedure call in this sort of commercial system, but they've made a lot of choices where they decided maybe that wasn't really a priority. Right, sort of the core functionality of a procedure call is still there, but there's a lot of stuff to deal with, like setup, which we kind of have to do, to handling errors, which is going to work differently, to deal with what if the versions are out of sync, and so on. So it's not really the same as a local procedure call, but maybe it's a more convenient interface than like using connections would be, using sockets, and translating everything to bytes yourself, and so on. Question, I guess. So far, you know, I've shown RPC as the idea of, oh, I'm running one thing on one machine and one thing on another machine. Another surprisingly common use of RPC is on a single machine, just as a way to communicate between two different processes. And you might say, don't we have better options? Well, maybe. Like, we could have a pipe between the two processes. They could open files on the local machine. But RPC, like, it might just be a better interface than, like, dealing with putting stuff in a file or writing stuff to a pipe. And so it's actually pretty common to see it in use on a local machine. And if you actually want to make it efficient, like, you can do that. Because, like, yes, you can do it on a local machine using your networking stuff, but you could also have an implementation that uses shared memory and mutexes and condition variables. And an advantage of doing this with an RPC system is, well, the RPC system is just a library, right? We can change what's in that library pretty easily separately from changing the rest of the system. So we can provide the same interface, but implement it in something that's much closer in performance to a function call for the local machine case. Some questions about RPC generally before we talk about failure a bit. Okay. And I should mention we have an upcoming assignment where we're going to use RPC, and generally for testing, we're going to do it all locally. So we're going to use not the network stuff, we're going to use sort of a local version. We're going to use sockets locally, it turns out, but sockets that don't work over the internet. Because that's useful, but that's sort of actually a relatively common thing for just communicating between machine processes. You know, like for example, on Linux, sort of the usual thing that manages the display uses something, you know, uses sort of that type of local communication, maybe not this way, but some of the services related to desktop stuff on Linux use this sort of idea, where they effectively have RPC, but just locally. Something akin to RPC. Okay, so let's talk about failures, and we're gonna first talk about network failures. And there's sort of our model of how networks are gonna work. We have this sort of mailbox model, and in that model, there's gonna be two sorts of ways we're gonna be concerned about networks failing. So one is that I can send a message and it gets lost. And another is that I can send a message and it gets delayed or reordered. So a message getting lost is like I'm on a Wi-Fi and the Wi-Fi just doesn't work. Well, the message is not going to get anywhere. The message being delayed or reordered is a little less obvious. Why would that happen? So there's a couple of reasons that can happen. So one reason is that if I think of sending a message like from DC to LA, there's actually a lot of ways that you get there, and they're not all the same speed. And my message often will not consistently go on one or the other, so they're not going to get to the destination in the same order I sent them. Another reason that's maybe more common in practice is that it's common for things to try to give reliability on a single step. So for example, my machine talking to the Wi-Fi might try to see if each thing it sends to my Wi-Fi router gets received. And if it doesn't, after a while it will send it again. But this means that the messages end up going out of my local network onto the internet in a different order than when I originally sent them. So how can we deal with messages being lost? Well, the way we can detect this is with acknowledgments. And this is something that connection systems often try to do, but there's going to be limitations. And that's what we're going to talk about mainly, is about what are these limitations, how do they affect, what sort of failures we can deal with. So we can detect with an acknowledgment that the remote machine tells us, yes, I got it. And we can recover by retrying. So we can just try again. And this should remind you of sort of our redo logging example, that if we don't have an acknowledgement based on the log being freed that it's done, we just try again. We can't distinguish, several different cases. So one thing we can't tell is we can't tell the difference between did my original message get lost or did I just not get the yes, I got it message? No way to know. We're just going to retry some extra times. We can't tell, did the machine not send the yes, I got it message because it was just being really slow or because it was actually down? Can't really tell. So with network failures in mind, let's think of an RPC system that's built on top of this. And we have two options. So one option is we send this call to the server, and then this call, we don't actually care about what it returns. We're just making a directory. So let's just assume we send it and we're done. That's option A. And option B is maybe we do care. So you wait for the server to return okay, and if we wait too long, we give up. So let's say I make these two calls, and they throw an exception or they don't. Question is, could the directory have been created, or if it threw an exception, even though I got an exception? And if it didn't throw an exception, could the directory have not been created? I'm going to emphasize, the gives up if waiting too long part, because I forgot to do that in the earlier section. That was important. I forgot to put that on the slide in the earlier section. You would like some more time? Okay, we'd still like some more time? Okay, so let's start with the first item. So let's say we have an exception at thrown when we try to do something for option A. So who thinks the directory could have been created? Who thinks the directory could not have been created? Okay, so we have like a 50-50 split. Okay, how about option B? Who thinks we try to do it, throws an exception, who thinks the directory could have been created? Thinks the directory could not have been created. So we again have a 50-50 split for option B. Okay. That's interesting. How about we don't get an exception? Option A, who thinks the directory could not have been created, even though we got no exception? Yes. Who thinks no? Okay, so we have most people say yes here. Okay. How about option B here? So we're implementing option B. We got no exception. Thinks the directory could not have been created. Thinks the directory could, so yes, not could create. So how about could directory could not, it's not true that the directory could not have been created. So most people on the no side of that. Okay. So let's start with these. So yeah, if we got no exception, then not only did we send the message to create the directory of the server, but the server said, okay. So that it must have gotten the message, and we're assuming only network failure, so that must have worked. So that, definitely true. Let's say for option A, I don't actually know if the server got the message. So could the directory have not been created? Yeah, the server could have just not gotten our message. So in that case, we have that is here. So then we have the issues of what if it throws an exception, where we have a lot of disagreements. Someone wants to make an argument for either answer for either part. Yeah.
So for option A, the directory could not be created because the stub would have thrown an exception before it actually sent to the server.
Okay. So your argument is, it seems like that the only thing the stub does is send a message. So if that failed, the server couldn't have gotten it. Okay. Yeah. Question, you think it's the opposite because messages could have been delayed and reordered?
So it's possible we got the exception out of order.
Because we got the exception out of order. Okay, so this is where I think a confusion is. You're assuming that the exception is going to happen because we're going to learn something from the server. But that's not what I'm specifying for option A here. It returns when it's sent to the server. So when it sends it over the network, it returns. There's nothing here about returning based on anything coming back from the server. So it's true, we might get a message from the server later on, but that's not going to affect whether this call returns or not under option A. And that might seem like a bad design, but that's the design we've written down. Does that answer your, clarify things? Yeah, but it's true that your instinct was that, well, we shouldn't do that. Silly. But under that model, like we're only going to find out about the error after it returns. And when it's too late for it to throw an exception. So I would say, so for option A, could the directory have needed, I would say probably not. So assuming we can't fail in a way where we think we sent the message and we didn't, probably not. But I'm not actually sure whether that might not be the case. Maybe we could fail in a way where we think we didn't send the message and we did. But probably couldn't have been. But it's uncertain. How about, so for B, could the directory have been created? Yes?
So if you lost the ACK from the server after it, the directory, it's still possible.
So yes, and this is if lost the acknowledgement. So we would have just given up for waiting too long, but the server really did it. Yeah. Or alternately, maybe we waited and we tried again and then the network didn't work. But maybe the server got it the first time. That would be another sort of way this could happen. You know, if we try again, but when we tried again, we knew the network was down, but that didn't mean it didn't get there the first time. You know, same thing, just losing the acknowledgement. Questions on my answers here. Okay, so we have our two cases, and generally what we have to worry about, if I just send a message, in this example, I'm going to send not to make a directory, but to append to a file. This is a more interesting thing. I don't know whether it got there if I just send it. That was our option A. I can try to get a reply, and if I get a reply, it's great, but if I don't, I can't really tell if I just lost the reply or didn't get there. I can't tell whether it's this scenario at the bottom here or the one at the bottom here where it just didn't get there, right? And there's no difference from machine A's point of view between the two scenarios. Just the same. I sent something and didn't get anything back. Don't know why. So what you'll want to do when we're retrying is we're going to want to retry in a way where we again see this idempotence idea. That just like with redo logging where I need to make sure I can do it again, I'm going to want to make sure I don't say append to the file again. I say append only if you haven't before in some way. And we can basically just keep retrying over and over again. That's sort of the best we can do to deal with these network failures. But if we give up, we're never going to actually know, did our last attempt actually work and we didn't get an acknowledgement or not? Or one of our earlier attempts worked and we didn't get an acknowledgement. So, that's going to be that's just an inevitable problem with how the network fails. So that when things fail, we sometimes won't know if the server actually acted on it or not. So the other thing we're worried about is reordering. And this is fairly simple. And we can detect this with sequence numbers. Basically, we have a sequence of messages. We just number them. And we pay attention to those numbers. Connection-based protocols usually handle this for you. For RPC, if we have two RPC calls, generally, they're not ordered. As far as the server is concerned, you might care about the order. The RPC system's not going to, distinguish that for you. But sort of the solution is, if we mark, we have part one and part two, we can make sure that we handle them correctly on the other end. We can also make sure that when we get an acknowledgement, that we know what it's for. That I acknowledge part one and part two. If I got part two, I would know I'm missing part one and not part two. So it's important that I have these sort of labels, which are just my sequence numbers. And as I said, connection-based protocols do this, but if we have two different connections, they're not going to be numbered together. So, and that's often going to happen if you make two different remote procedure calls, right? There's no reason why the system is going to make sure one happens before the other just because you thought you called one first. Because the network might send the one you called first might arrive later. Okay. Questions about network failures generally, before we talk about machine failure. So I've talked about messages on the network. We don't get them, they get delayed. That's sort of the failures we're considering. For machine failure, we're gonna talk about how machines fail. We want to deal with systems that work when machine fail. I mentioned for distributed systems, a big motivation is that we hope having extra machines, maybe we can handle if some of those machines don't work. And there's two big ways people think about machine failure, two models we can have. So one model is called fail stop. This says that when a machine's failing, it just stops responding. This doesn't work. So it's as if when it fails, it just shuts down or crashes. And this model, if you think of how things often fail, it's not actually that bad. You think your program crashes, it stops working and just doesn't do anything. If the machine's unplugged, loses power, stops working. If the disk doesn't work, the machine is just not going to respond to anything. And you can kind of force this to happen. If you can detect it's broken, you can just turn it off, right? That's sort of the assumption of this model, is that when it's broken, it effectively turns off. So a different model, different extreme, is what we'll call Byzantine failures. And in this model, we're going to just assume the failing machine does the worst possible thing. Because we think of failures. If I think of, for example, my like mint directory or append case, you know, the worst thing I can do, the worst way that things could fail is the machine could say, yep, I made that directory, and nothing, it didn't actually do anything. Right? That's a possible way things could fail. Different things would have to go wrong. That would be really inconvenient. But, you know, if we want to think of how could things really fail, we want to handle those, you know, pretty much any sort of failure. So the Byzantine failure model says, let's assume machines do the worst possible thing. Because if we handle them doing the worst possible thing, we'll handle all the weird things they actually do. They might say, wait a moment, how do I ever make a system that deals with machines doing the worst possible thing? And the answer is we're going to assume some of the machines work and some of them fail for both of these. We're going to say we're going to handle not all of our machines shutting down, like fail stop. We're going to handle some of them doing that. We're not going to handle all of our machines choosing to do the worst possible thing, like reply to my yes, I made that directory message with yes, but not actually do make the directory. We're going to assume only a bounded number of those machines do that. So we're going to talk about dealing with fail stop. I want you to know, well, of course, not all failures look like this. Like, things can fail by corrupting your data. That's a real thing that happens. And the fail stop model doesn't tell you how to deal with that. And we're going to talk about dealing with things that fail in the fail stop way, but you know, we want to do different things if we actually want to handle certain types of real failures. And if we talk about handling failures, there's a lot of things that could mean. And we're going to focus in an upcoming assignment and next lecture on recovering when a machine comes back up. So my assumption is going to be I'm going to have this machines fail by effectively shutting down. We're somehow going to get them to stop failing. And when that happens, I want the system to be in a good state again. And why is that going to be hard? Well, because I have a distributed system. One machine could contact another asking it to, say, make a directory. And we need to deal with, well, we don't actually know if that directory got made. We need to recover from that situation. So we're going to talk about a systematic way of making sure that happens. So there's a different type of dealing with failure that I want you to know exists, but we're not going to talk about the details of implementing, which is relying on a quorum of machines working. So if I have, you know, 10 machines, I might say, as long as one of them is working, the system should work. You know, or as long as, you know, 8 of them are working, the system should still work. I can design systems to work in that way. That's a very different problem. We're not going to really talk about how to solve that, but I want you to know there are ways of doing that. How many extra machines you mean depends on how you think machines fail. If you think machines should shut down, well, you basically only need one extra. If you think machines to do the Byzantine failure thing, it turns out there's a famous result that you need 3F plus 1 if F of them fail. So you need a minimum of 4 machines to handle one machine doing the worst possible thing. Okay. So questions about sort of the type of machine failure, we're, you know, how we're recovering from failure in terms of like what scenarios we handle. Okay, so we're going to talk about transactions again. So we mentioned for redo logging that a transaction would do some operation all at once or not at all, right? And we'd handle that by writing down the steps of the operation, then writing down that we agreed to do it, and then actually doing it later on. We're going to do that same thing with a distributed transaction. So we're going to have 2 or more machines doing different parts of the same operation. And we want that to happen even if one of those machines fails, and it's going to fail in the fail stop way. We're not going to handle it failing in the Byzantine failure way, you know, because that's going to be much harder. And like with our redo logging case, our primary goal is going to be to get a consistent state. You know, so if my operation is like to create a file on create directories on 2 machines, I want my state to be either the directories on both machines or it's on neither. Nothing in between. So our primary goal is a consistent state. Our secondary goal is that if no machine fails, we want things to actually work. When machines fail, we're going to be okay with, you know, the transaction not happening, but we don't ever want to get in a state where the transaction is half done. So like the scenario with redo logging, I said, like, if we remove a file, I don't want to see, like, a ghost extra copy of the file or the file disappearing. That's really unacceptable. But it's going to be okay if we don't do the file move because things were breaking. But if things don't break, we'd like to actually do it. And sort of as an example of like how this might work, let's say I have a database of courses across several machines. And machines A and B is where I store all the information about students. And machine C is where I store all the information about courses. And if I want to add a student to a course, I want to update, say, machine A and machine C. Machine A for the students' information, machine C for the courses' information. And I want to make sure that even if machine A or machine B or machine C go down during this operation or the network stops working, that when they come back up, when things are working, that I'm never going to have a case where I tell a student they're in a course, but they're not because I'm looking at the course student records, but when I look at the course records, they're not there, or vice versa. So we're going to talk about a way of doing that. And part of how we're going to make sure this works is that we're going to make it possible to say, no, I can't do that because of a failure, even though maybe, you know, things might work later. But we're at least when things aren't going to fail, we're going to make sure this actually works. But when failures do happen, we're going to make sure we don't end up with a state where you're half in a course. And you can see sort of the motivation for having a distributed transaction with this, because you know it would be really inconvenient to have that half-done operation. That would be really confusing. Okay. And I'm ahead of the other lecture, but where should I? I guess I should. So let's think about the naive way of doing this. So let's say I just tell machine A to update the student record, machine C to update the course record. What's wrong with that? How is that going to fail? How is that not going to work? So let's say A, add student, add S to C, and if I tell C, I guess I should see like student.addCourse, right? So what's wrong with doing this? What could go wrong if I just do the simple thing where I tell machine A, add student to the course, machine C, add course, with the course, add the student? Yes. Yeah, so any one of these could fail because I'm contacting machine A, machine C, either one could fail. So this could fail, and this could work, or I could have the other way around, in which case the operation would end up half done, unless I had some mechanism to make sure I tried again. So let's say I keep trying. What could go wrong still? Yeah. Why isn't it possible to send a remove message? Great idea. So I'm going to try to add. So let's say I did this scenario where I just tried to add both of them. And your idea is, well, after I see I don't get an acknowledgement from C, I send a remove message. Is that your proposal? So I don't get an acknowledgement from C, so I'm going to do A, S dot remove C, right? And OK, I'm going to send that to C too, OK. And course dot remove S. Someone tell me what can go wrong here. So we might be sending a bad remove request. Let's assume we just ignore if the student doesn't exist. What could still go wrong? Yeah. Yeah, so A could go down then. And that's actually not even, so the problem is A could go down, and that's not improbable, because maybe the reason we couldn't contact C is because the network failed right after we the network on the machine we're sending the request on failed right after we contacted A. That would actually be pretty common. Anything else which could go wrong? Yeah. Sorry, machine. Question, doesn't machine B being a copy of the student record? Oh, the assumption I'm having is that the student records are split across machines A and B, depending on which student they're for. But yes, good question. Other ways things can go wrong? Yeah.
Why isn't it possible to cycle?
Question, why isn't it possible to cycle until we have a consistent state? So we can try to do that, but while we're cycling, we have an inconsistent state. And that's a problem. Right? And given how long machines could be down, it could be cycling for quite a while, or the network could be down. And your promise of cycling means, so that's one reason. So another reason is, what if the machine I'm running this code on to send these messages fails? I need to handle that too. Okay, that. And I'm surprised no one brought that up, but that's another big issue, right? This is the machine I'm trying to do this on could fail itself. I need to somehow deal with that. Other questions? So next time we'll have a protocol which is a systematic solution to this problem. And a key part of that solution that's going to make it possible is that we'll have a way of effectively saying, no, I don't have an answer for you right now. It's a key part of our design. And also, it's not going to be surprising, we're going to reuse ideas from redo logging. We're going to do redo logging in this system to make it work. And that's going to be, not only the next topic, but also our final assignment. So we're going to have a protocol called two-phase commit, a design called two-phase commit, which will solve this type of problem.